So there's this concept of dips and dead ends, which I think originated in the business world. So it's the idea that as you begin, you learn at a rapid rate, you see lots of results. Like a startup company, you'll see some easy growth, they'll attract lots of clients. But at some point, the novelty wears off and it's no longer fun. And the results start to dip, no new clients, the revenue's down. But this concept of dips and dead ends, it's not really about the dip itself. It's about what happens after the dip, because the dip always comes. But the question is it a dip or is it a dead end? Is it a temporary downturn and after that bigger and better things are coming? Or is it a slow and painful descent? So it's a simple idea, but recognizing the dip can make a world of difference. So we'll look at something a bit more concrete. Amazon entered the stock market on May 15th, 1997, and the price was $18 a share. 3 years later, at the height of the dot-com bubble around the 2000, it was worth $100 a share. So that's a huge profit of 500%. And then 1 year after that, the bubble burst in 2001, and it was worth as little as $7. So if you said, this is not a dip, this is a dead end, and you sold your Amazon stock, you'd have lost half your money. Better than losing all of it, though. But it would be tough to know at the time. Will I lose money? Will I make some back? What's going to happen? With the benefit of hindsight, we know that it was definitely just a dip, because July this year, Amazon shares touched the $2,000 mark. So if you held through the dip, you would have made 10,000% profit. So it's big stakes when it comes to dips and dead ends. But this idea of dips and dead ends isn't just locked into the business world. You can see this pattern in all parts of life. You're writing an assignment, you get motivated, you get a brilliant idea, you start making tons of progress, and then you hit a complicated section and you lose momentum and then you can't be bothered. Is it a dip? If you grind it out, will you get a 95%? Will you get a HD? Or should you just call it now and cash in 51%? Naomi says, cash it in. You can apply it to relationships, right? You meet someone new and you're like, oh, hey, and she's all right. Or maybe he's all right. And you get to know them. They say yes to going out for a coffee. They're amazing. But then after a little while, you start to notice all their quirks and slightly annoying habits. And you're like, oh, is this a dip? Do you persevere through this and this ends up being the person you marry? Or is it a dead end and you should jump ship before it goes down in flames? Apply it to a new job. Apply it to raising kids, apply it to getting fit, you get the idea, right? It goes up and it goes down. Is it a dip or is it a dead end? Today we're going to apply it to the Christian life, because underlying this passage is the idea of dips and dead ends. It's the shape of Christian history and it's even the shape of our individual Christian lives. So in verse 1, Jesus says, "All this I've told you so that you will not go astray or not fall away." Jesus insinuates to the disciples that very soon they're going through a dip, probably a very significant dip, because they're tempted to go astray. The "all this" in "all this I've told you" is probably referring to what he's been telling them that night, the night of the Passover feast, which is what we've been looking at for the past few chapters. He's been hinting at themes of love and of service and of obedience, but also of his betrayal, his going to the cross and the coming of the Spirit and the departure of Jesus. So all these things he's been telling the disciples to prepare them for the profound dip that's going to come, the persecution that's going to come in their life. What will it look like? In verse 2, it tells them it looks like them getting thrown out of the synagogues. You might think, no big deal. These guys are Christians. They don't need a synagogue anyway. The dip isn't so bad. But you'd be mistaken. The synagogue in those times wasn't just a place for worship. It was a place for communal life, for learning, for eating together. It functioned as a hostel. It was a place for distributing charity to those in need. It was a place for political meetings and where legal decisions were made. And it was a place of worship. So being kicked out of synagogues in those times wasn't like being kicked out of a Christian church today. It's more like being kicked out of the schools and the universities and the libraries and the community centres and the safe places to stay when you're travelling, and also removing any government safety nets like the DOL or the New Start allowance or aged care and disability pension. and removing the voice that you have in government, and removing your access to the justice system, and being kicked out of church. So it wasn't like you lost everything, but you lost a lot. So it was a big dip. It was heavy persecution. But that wasn't all. On top of that, Jesus says a time is coming, or more literally, an hour is coming. And you might recognize that phrase because John uses it a lot. And it's not really a pleasant thing. The hour in John, or the time in John, is pretty much always talking about Jesus' hour. The hour that he'll do something incredibly hard. When he'll be betrayed by one of his closest friends, when he'll be beaten and humiliated, and when he'll die on the cross. So here Jesus tells them, you have an hour coming as well. For the disciples, their hour also means they'll be walking into persecution and to death. And they'll be so hated that people will kill them and think they're doing God a favour. It's not so different from the hour that Jesus is walking into. You might remember a few years ago the beheading of 21 Coptic Christians by Islamic State in the name of God, or so that group believed, I guess. That's the very literal fulfillment of the killing that Jesus is talking about here. It might be quite rare, at least according to the news that we see these days, but it happens. But it also happens more commonly in a figurative sense. So we're going to watch an interview. It is a bit long, it's about 5 minutes, but I think it sets the modern Western context pretty well for us. So I'll hopefully play this. It's a bit lengthy, but we'll watch it till pretty much the end.
Should transgender rights trump religious beliefs? Dr. David McAreth joins us from Birmingham. Very good morning to you. What is the religious belief which stops you using the chosen pronoun of those who have transitioned?
Well, I think we have to start by recognising how important pronouns are within our language. This is a complete change in the way we use them. And even if we leave the religious factor out, we have a problem that by changing the way we use pronouns, we completely change who we are as a society and who we are as people. And it doesn't just affect a small group of people, it affects every single one of us. But as a Christian, I believe that to use pronouns in that way is dishonest. And I cannot do that in a good conscience.
But let me ask you, what is the pronoun that you object to? Because if somebody born biologically male transitions to be female, why would you not respect that? Why would you not just call them she?
Okay, the sound quality was poor, but I understand the question to be, if somebody has transferred from being male to female, why could I not also change my use of pronouns? The answer is I don't believe that a person can change sex. I don't believe a person can change gender and that sex and gender are the same thing.
Do you understand that that makes you a bigot?
Define bigot for me.
A bigot is somebody woefully intolerant of people who go through an extraordinarily long and painful transition process, both physically and psychologically, and they do it because fundamentally they believe they were born in the wrong body, the wrong gender, the wrong sex. They believe that if they were born biologically male, they are actually women, they're female. And shouldn't you just find it in your Christian heart, given that you're such a Christian, to actually respect that?
Well, the Bible tells us that God has made us male and female. He made us for his own glory. If I'm a bigot, then the whole of Christianity throughout history is bigotry. I don't believe that. I believe Christianity is the truth of God.
The Bible says if you look at people in an adulterous manner, you should be stoned to death. Do you agree with that?
Yes, it does.
Okay, do you walk around the streets... Given your self-righteousness, do you wander around the streets of your city now looking for people who are looking at people in a lustful way and stone them to death?
You haven't established that I'm self-righteous, but I am a sinner saved by the grace of God through faith in Jesus Christ. So I carry the righteousness of Jesus Christ. I long for the same thing for everybody that I have, which is to know him. That includes people of every kind of background. You're right. If we were to apply the Bible literally without taking its context, every one of us could be stoned to death. Right. Every one of us has broken God's commandments. I'm not saying I'm better than anybody.
Have you ever looked at people in a sinful way, lustful way?
Well, Of course I have. Of course.
Okay,
I have.
Well, then you should. Applying the law of the Bible, you should now stone yourself to death. Let's go to transgender journalist India Willoughby. I mean, this is the problem, isn't it, to me? You know, I'm a Christian. Mm. I was brought up a Catholic. But when I hear this kind of stuff, my heart sinks. It's so intolerant of something which is clearly, if people go through a transitioning process from male to female or female to male, it's such an arduous thing to do. That's what I always think. Why would you put yourself through it if you didn't fundamentally believe, as you did clearly, that you're just, you know, that's what you want to be?
Well, the argument, you've just highlighted the very thing I was going to say, that the Bible is full of contradictions. Believe it or not, I used to go to Boys Brigade, and in Boys Brigade, we did Bible studies. And one of the passages in the Bible that says that you can't eat shellfish, and that if somebody eats a fish with shells on, they should be shunned. Mm. Now, would David refuse to
there's so many problems. But let me ask on a wider issue.
It's to speak of Jesus Christ and show us the way back to God.
Yeah, all right, mate. Jesus Christ told you to be tolerant of people as well. You seem to have failed that.
Religion getting into LGBT stuff, you can see what's going on about transgenderism.
Yeah, if you don't mind it for a moment.
It's like listening to God. He's not physically here, but we can hear the voice.
Do you think there are any circumstances in which somebody using their religious conviction to not want to use pronouns if people want to be referred to in a certain way? Do you have a respect for anyone that has that view?
Of course. Nobody is trying to clamp down on religion. I think personal religion views, if it brings you comfort and solace, I think it's a great thing. I think the issue is that it's now 2019. We live in a civilized society. And it's not the days of the Bible. You know, I think God would actually be really cool about transgender people.
Right.
If Jesus came back, he'd probably look like Conchita Wurst. He wouldn't be changing wine into water. He'd be changing men into women, women into men, doing all that.
Yeah, I mean, my final point to you, David, really, is that you've already accepted that because of your own sinful, lustful thoughts, you have to stone yourself to death. So it may be that you should also reconsider, given I presume you don't want to stone yourself to death.
Cleansed in the blood of Jesus Christ. That's what saves me.
Okay.
That's what will save anybody.
Yeah, it won't save you from being stoned to death for your sinful, lustful thoughts. And my point to you is this. If the Bible tells you
that... What has this got to do with transgenderism?
Because you are citing the Bible to defend your bigotry. And my point is, we've all moved on from large swathes of the Bible.
You're actually
allowed to evolve and move on.
If I spoke to my patients the way you are speaking to me, they would walk out and I would be before the GMC.
If I was your patient, I would ask you why have you not stoned yourself to death, given your historical Christianity that Jesus Christ is the saviour of the world.
Okay, just finally, we should talk in a civil manner, shouldn't we? I don't think you ranting at me is doing any good.
Well, actually, okay, all right. You know what?
Dr. David Macro, thank you very much.
Okay. Let's get David some stones.
Do you think we could have less stoning to death at this time of the morning, please?
His words, not mine.
I don't want to.
He has the conviction that everything in the Bible must be implemented. One of them is if you have lustful, sinful thoughts about members of the opposite sex, you have to stone yourself to death.
Ooh. So I found that clip pretty frustrating, to say the least. Forget about how well you think Dr. Macro did or didn't stand up for Christianity, forget about the topic of transgenderism. But notice how he was cut off. Notice how his words were taken out of context. Notice how God's words were taken out of context. See how they spoke for Jesus and said, Jesus would do this. See how taking this guy down on TV was doing the whole world a favour. They were happy with what they'd done, proud of it. They were even doing God a favour. So we live in an hour where if we stick our necks out as Christians, we are figuratively and occasionally literally killed in the service of justice and freedom and righteousness and love and all these godly things, and even in the service of God himself. So we live in the dip. But they've got it wrong. Verse 3 tells us that Piers Morgan, who was the guy on Good Morning Britain, and the panel that were with him got it wrong. That Islamic State got it wrong. They think they know God and they think they act for him, but verse 3 says their actions show that they don't. And sadly, we shouldn't be shocked at this. In the first half of verse 4, Jesus reminds us that this time that we live in now was always good. And then to tip things over the edge, there's one more piece of bad news, and that is that Jesus is going to leave them. The hour of Jesus and the hour of the disciples are taking them in two different directions. Jesus is going to the cross and returning to the one who sent him, to the Father. But the disciples are going to their own profound persecution. Jesus didn't tell them about the coming dip from the start because they didn't need to know. That's the end of verse 4. It's not that they weren't persecuted while Jesus was around. They were still rejected in lots of ways while he was around. But Jesus was there, and he was like the lightning rod, attracting the attention and the outrage of the persecutors. But in a matter of hours, he'd be gone. But the disciples are so burdened with this that Jesus mentions in verse 5 that they didn't even ask where he was going. That's a strange comment, and I'll return to that in a second. But the disciples reach some incredible lows in their life post-Jesus. They're going to be jailed and persecuted in a variety of ways. Most of them will die horribly as a direct result of their faith. And the same is true for generation after generations of Christian right up into this room today. For us, he's been gone for 2,000 years, but we still live in the chaotic world without him. Think of a time that you reached a low because of your faith. Think of a time you were either persecuted because of your faith or a time that you hid your faith because you were scared of persecution. It might have been a small way. Maybe you heard some laughing or snickering in the background as you prayed in a public restaurant. Maybe you pulled back from telling a friend about Jesus, even when you thought it might comfort them, even when you thought they actually wanted to hear about it, because you were afraid. Maybe it was a bigger way. Maybe your beliefs and following Jesus meant that your job was on the line. We've got stories of that all over the world now. Like bakers who wrongly or rightly don't want to make cakes for same-sex weddings. Conceivably, it might become illegal to profess our faith publicly in this country one day. It's probably a pretty small chance, but it could be. It's definitely not becoming less likely that that's going to happen. And conceivably, some of us could end up with fines or jails because of what we say and who we follow. Whatever it is, think about a time when you've been laid low because of your faith. And then imagine Jesus was with you physically in that moment. He was standing right next to you. How different would that be? How much more courage would you have? How much more conviction in your beliefs? How much more perseverance and willingness to suffer? Incredibly different, right? And now take it away again, because that's the reality we live in. Jesus isn't here. His disciples' hearts were filled with grief in verse 6. They had Jesus, and with Jesus they could weather anything. But without Jesus, they're alone in the storm, like we're alone in the storm. We live as followers of Jesus without Jesus. So the disciples historically in John, and every disciple since Jesus has left, has had to make a choice. We've had to decide if these hard times in the Christian life is a dip or if it's a dead end. In the moment, in the middle of persecution, in the middle of the dip, it's hard to tell. In the moment, you didn't know if Amazon stock was going to go back up or if it was going to bust. In the moment, you don't know if that time in the gym is going to lead to a better body. In the moment, you don't know if your mundane job now is going to be your dream job in about 10 minutes. But Jesus promises that for certain, this is a dip. And I think that's what makes sense of his strange comment in verse 5. Why does Jesus mention that no one asks him where he's going to go? It's not because he's bitter about no one caring about him or something, but I think it's because if someone asks that question, the answer would give them hope. He's going to the Father in verse 5, and in verse 7 we get to see why this is hope. Because when Jesus goes to the Father, he'll send the Spirit. And we've had hints of how good this is earlier in John. We know that the Spirit will actively be in each one of us and it will connect us to Jesus, even though he's far away. And as far as this passage goes in verse 7, it tells us it's for our good. And that's another phrase which you might recognise. Here it's translated for our good, but it's been used once before in John, only once before. You'd have to remember back about 2 years ago when we preached on John chapter 11, verse 50. And they say about Jesus, "You do not realize that it's better for you that one man die for the people than for the whole nation to perish." There it's saying that it's better that Jesus, one person, dies instead of a whole nation dying. It's definitely a better trade. And in the same way, to the same extent, here Jesus says, this is a better trade, that I leave so that the Spirit can come. We can't really imagine how it could be that Jesus, who's tangible, leaving could be a good thing, and how the Spirit, who's intangible, coming could be better. But he promises it is. And in the rest of John 16, which we'll look at in the next few weeks, we'll hear a ton more detail about what the Spirit will do when he comes, what the Spirit is doing right now in us. But for now, this verse tells us that Jesus leaving is a good thing, is a better thing. And the persecution that follows, therefore, must also be a good thing. And that's our hope in this hour. We're promised that this time of persecution is a dip and not a dead end. So Christianity then is a faith with a dip. It's a faith with persecution. Historical Christianity dips when Jesus leaves, and we live in that dip today. In Australia, it seems our country is slowly sliding into a dip that more reflects historical Christianity. Christianity in Australia is being rejected, and so are Christians. What was once normal or accepted, even if people didn't believe it at a heart level, is not normal or accepted anymore. Things like same-sex marriage, things like abortion, which at one time were acceptable to stand against, are now not. It's not the fact that they're now legalised. That's kind of neither here or there, but it's that we can't voice an opinion over it without being taken down. We're entering, or we've probably entered, a dip in Australia. Without faith comes persecution. Historically and nationally, we're in a dip. And personally, we might be entering a dip too, or maybe you're already in a dip. It's just the pattern of life for Christians. It can sneak up on you. Dips come at your highest point. By their nature, they come at your highest point. You're loving work, but it asks you to do something that you can't do because you're a Christian. And if you refuse, persecution will come. You'll enter a dip. You love your relationship, but because you're a Christian, there are some things that you cannot do in a relationship, and that might jeopardize it. Or because you're a Christian, there are some people that you cannot date, although you'd like to. And so your personal life enters a dip. The reason that Jesus speaks what he speaks to the disciples in this passage is the same reason we need to hear it today. Because there's a dip on the horizon, maybe nationally, maybe personally. And when we enter that dip, it's going to look exactly like a dead end. Christianity couldn't recover from this. My faith can't stand up through this. It's not worth it. There won't be anything better. This is the end. And when you enter that dip, you'll have to make a choice. Is it a dip or is it a dead end? Jesus promises to us today that it's a dip. The Spirit coming to us and living in us promises that this is a dip. That every persecution in the life of a Christian is a dip. The profound persecution of the disciples was a dip. The persecution in your life is a dip. It's not a dead end. If you endure it, Jesus promises that it is better.